You're listening to the Useful Science Podcast, produced in collaboration with the Moorhead Planetarium and Science Center. This week, we're talking about cultural change. Useful Science is a website where we post one-sentence summaries of scientific research relevant to your everyday life. On this podcast, we bring on a rotating panel of our science contributors to pick out a few items from the Useful Science archives and dive deep into them. So while the website gives you the short, tweetable version of scientific research, our goal here is to give you the full story. Let's meet our hosts for this week.
Hi, I'm Jamie K. Devine. I'm an operational fatigue scientist at the Institute for Behavior Resources in Baltimore.
And I'm Joshua Conrad Jackson. I'm a PhD student in the Department of Psychology at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I study how culture changes over time and the impact of culture on human psychology. And actually, this is my last episode of Useful Science, which is really strange and sad to say. I can still remember recording episode number one more than 5 years ago now, and I've had a lot of fun recording between then and now. Before we started this episode, I was scrolling through the history of our episodes, and I realized that this will be my 20th episode, I think. So it's nice to end on a nice round number.
Wow, 20 out of 50.
Yeah, 20 out of 50.
Well, actually, by this point, 20 out of, 55 or so?
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure if I've done any ones in the backlog, but who knows? Anyway, but I was actually counting our episodes, and of the ones that we've published, which are 49, Jamie and I have been on the exact same number. We've been on 19 each. And so I thought it was fitting that Jamie and I did this one together, this last episode.
Are you two the only contributors that were there from the beginning that are still involved?
Ian also.
Yeah. Ian, yeah. That's right. Yeah.
I think it's been us three. I was looking at the beginning and I didn't see a whole lot of names that are still around apart from Ian, Jamie, and I.
Yeah.
Well, it's been a long time. It's been like 5 years.
Yeah.
Well, you know, that's funny. I'm looking right now. Episode one is Ian, Jamie, and Josh.
There you go.
How about that?
Yeah.
Look at that.
Stuck it out.
Yeah. It's like Highlander. There can be only one.
Who will be the last OG host? Well, I mean, Cameron has us all beat by like twice as many plus more.
Well, yeah, but there's what, 50 episodes? And by the time this airs, there'll be, I guess, closer to 55, and Cameron's mm-hmm. been on 55 of them.
Yeah, but my job is easy. I've probably done as much work as any single person has, even if they've only been on a fraction of the episodes I've been on, because I don't have to prepare anything.
Cameron's selling himself short, though, because for a long time, you were the editor.
Well, and you're assuming that, like, we put work into it. We could just be, you know, faking it.
Yeah, I wonder if anybody's just made up an article. I know they haven't.
Just at the last moment, I'm recording a Useful Science episode. What's new?
It's like giving a book report on a book you haven't read.
Yeah. Well, people do a good job, so if they do that, they pull it off. Anyway, so we're talking about cultural change. That was my suggestion. You hear it in my little bio every week that this is what I study. And so I thought that it was appropriate because, you know, since this is my last episode, change is on my mind. But also I had a selfish motivation to talk about some work that really interests me. And so Jamie's going to get us started. She's going to talk about how people make decisions about change. And then I'm going to talk about an interesting kind of case study in cultural change over the last 100 or 200 years that has lots of implications for how we live today.
All right. So my article is Status Quo Bias in Decision Making from Samuelson and Zechhauser. This was published in the Journal of Risk and Uncertainty in 1988. So this is an old paper. And what they discuss in this is there's a bias in decision making to just do nothing. So take the decision that changes nothing and maintains your status quo. And they did a series of experiments where they tested how much someone would choose a status quo framed argument versus a neutral framing. So, for example, you are voting for a president and you have two options. Maybe you've got candidate A and candidate B. Who do you pick? Versus you are voting for an election. You have candidate A, who is the incumbent, the president who's already in office, and you've got candidate B. And so they found that when you frame a question to lead people to believe that choosing one option or another will either maintain their status quo or disrupt it. People choose to keep the status quo. They don't like change, as it were. So people don't like change. And they gave some examples of status quo effects in practice over the years. So one was a town in Germany. They decided to come up and relocate the town and do, plan out the streets. And the townspeople selected a serpentine layout. So they chose a poorly designed street setup as opposed to like a grid because they were used to it.
Relocate the city?
Yeah, it's...
Like they're building a dam or something?
Let's see. A West German government undertook a strip mining project that by law required the relocation of a small town underlain by a lignite being mined. So The government had to move the people so that they could get the sweet, sweet lignite that was underneath their feet. Another one is, you eat the same thing for lunch every day. So if you go to a restaurant, you just order the normal and do that for years. And one that I thought was really interesting was in 1980, Schlitz Brewing Company launched a series of live beer taste tests on network television. So they had a panel of 100 confirmed Budweiser drinkers. These are people who drank at least 2 6-packs of Bud a week. And they gave them this taste test and they preferred Schlitz. So the idea is that they're choosing Bud because they've always chosen Bud, even though they don't prefer it. But I find that interesting because everybody knows what Budweiser is. You can find Budweiser everywhere, but you can't find Schlitz. And if Schlitz tastes better, why isn't Schlitz more popular? So that was, science aside, that was what I found most interesting about this article. But what I do think is not only the takeaway is that if you experimentally test people, they prefer to make decisions that do not change the status quo. But this was done in 1988. And I know that status quo bias is an established thing in psychology, but I've wondered how might that bias have changed over the years. And certainly after this past year, where status quo has been pretty terrible, and we've all had to abandon status quo. What does that mean for the change? And I guess in some ways, how does that explain people who are unwilling to make alterations to their lifestyle that are going to protect their own health and the health of others?
So you're wondering about if, like, does the status quo bias have a breaking point? If things get bad enough, does it no longer matter whether something's framed as the status quo or not?
Yeah, is there a breaking point? And then also, they tested people in 1988, so that's a different generation. This is mostly probably the boomer generation, which the millennials have been banging their heads against this unwillingness to change status quo. So I'm wondering if there's a generational effect as well.
Yeah, it could be that the bias goes the other way, I guess, for a different generation, that they, if they're dissatisfied with the status quo, that they might have a bias towards change, even in silly things like which beer, to go with.
Yeah.
I personally think Schlitz is disgusting. I'm sorry. I will go on the record.
But is it more disgusting than Budweiser?
I guess that's the question. I think I would go with the status quo, whatever is around. Mm.
I was going to say that I've never bought the same beer 2 times in a row. I go to the convenience store and be like, oh, what haven't I tried yet?
Well, maybe you're the testament then. You're the new generation.
Right.
Do you drink 2 6-packs a week?
No, I don't. Well, that's not too
that's
far
12.
Off.
That's
12. Yeah.
But that's got to be like 12 Bud Heavies a week. That's
Bud Heavies.
Bud Heavies.
It's just like the Budweiser. They're not Bud Lights.
Bud Light.
Oh, got it. Got it.
Bud Heavies.
Yeah.
I know that there's still lots of default bias around like retirement savings, people's decisions about putting like monthly payments into retirement plans and organ donation. Like people are just as bad at recognizing that just because something is the default they shouldn't use that. Like if mm-hmm. organ donation is the default when you die, then people are much, much more likely to sign up as organ donors than when it's an opt-in system. And that bias is still just as bad as it was a couple of decades ago. But I think that this question about sort of the severity of the topic, like it would be really interesting to say, for example, you know, if you didn't think that fracking was so bad, to see if default effects were at play, you know, right after a major fracking incident. Yeah. Yeah. So I don't know. I don't know any studies that have actually looked at like not so bad things versus really, really bad things and see whether this status quo bias changes.
Yeah, I guess one thing that Michael had said on one of our previous parenting episodes was that the university where he's at had made paternal leave opt-in, like you had to choose to take paternal leave. Mm-hmm. And they found that no one was taking it, so they changed that so that it was the default, so you would have to opt out.
Yeah.
And that has been very helpful for getting fathers to actually take time off and take care of their kids. It's funny because you think of decisions being something like an election, where you're really invested in it. And yet it can be something like when you sign up for a 401k and they say, do you want the default? Or when you download Microsoft and they say, do you want the default settings or do you want your own custom settings?
Yeah, custom settings are scary. I never choose that.
Yeah, I'm the same way.
So I have a question for both of you. If you were, you know, working at some public health agency or economics firm that was managing 401ks or something, would you use defaults? Like if you could present two options to people and you thought one option was in their interest, would you try to frame it as the status quo if you had the chance to?
Yeah, with something like a 401k, I would certainly appreciate being told, here's what most people do. Here's the other options. And I think you got a point there, Josh, that if your job is to help people make financial decisions and you think that one option is better than the other, then yeah, presenting it as the default does kind of help them come to that decision. Maybe it's manipulative if it's not literally a default.
Well, I asked because a couple of years ago, I think in 2017, yeah, 2017, they did this study where people had to take the role of a practitioner and they had to prescribe medication essentially. And they knew that one medication was in a patient's interest. And they had two options. They could either set that medication as the default and then have the patient opt out, or they could give the patient free choice over both medications while trying to like communicate that one was better. And so they found that when people were taking the role of the patient in this hypothetical dilemma, they would choose the default option more. Like if something was prescribed as the default, they wouldn't change it. But when people could behave as the practitioner, they didn't think the default would work. They didn't think that would actually make the patient more likely to keep using the medication. And so, you know, when you looked at their decisions, it was about 50% of people took that default choice and then 50% didn't. They just took like these are the two medications you can use. And so the point of that paper was that we don't actually know as well as we think we do what works with social influence. And so we don't take advantage of this really easy bias that everyone has to try to get people to make healthy decisions.
Let me make sure I understood. They were asking people to place themselves in the role of the practitioner and to predict what the patient would choose. And they predicted 50-50?
Yeah. So you're a practitioner, I'm your patient, and there are these two medications that you could give me. And you have two choices. So you can either make one of them the default and then have me kind of opt out to the other one, or you can just present both of them and you could have me choose. And people thought that, you know, people took those options 50-50, even though they knew that one was better.
But that's what the practitioner thought the patient would choose. The practitioner thought the patient would choose 50-50, but in reality, the patient preferred the default.
Exactly. So people, you know, the default effect is still alive and well, but we don't really use it as much as we could use it when we're in a position to try to influence people in a way that we think is healthy.
That's interesting.
We probably use it more when we're trying to influence people in a way that's not healthy. signing up for listservs or newsletters when you create a profile and they always send you all that stuff and you have to opt out. That's marketing departments seem pretty good at using the default option to get us to do what they want us to do, even though it's not really in our best benefit.
That's a good point, because they did have like an expert sample. They had people who had just were about to graduate from Stanford Law School do this study, and they were better at using the default, slightly better. They were like 60%.
Well, so if you are giving people two choices and you want them to pick one choice, but it's not necessarily in their best interest to pick that choice, such as signing up for your newsletter, I can see why you would take advantage of this. But if you're like the practitioner and you're offering two medicines and one you think is going to work, the other you think is not going to work, why even offer the choice? I mean, like, why not? This is what we do, right? Like, why is it even a choice?
Well, and here's my question. Which one's cheaper?
Oh, yeah, that's a good point.
That's what I want to know.
That's a good point. Yeah.
That's probably more what's really happening, right? Like, the patient has this one medication, which is really expensive, is going to go outside of their insurance, or versus another medication that is going to be cheaper, is going to be covered entirely by insurance, but it's not quite as good. I mean, you know so much more about this than I do, Jamie.
What about medications or about choosing things because I'm cheap?
I don't know about the second one, at least the first.
Certainly price is like the number one thing for my decision making. Mm. And in terms of price points, that's not my department. My institute also does have behavioral economics, which is a really interesting field where you decide, or you like graph how people make choices and price points for demand, personal demand. So it's very interesting. And I work with someone who I recruited to become a useful science contributor now. So I'm doing Jan's work for him. But I, like, maybe because I know how much work goes into that, I do not want to pretend to know anything. But it is, you know, that's a huge part of decision making. And one of the things that we'll do is ask people how likely are you to buy something at this price or at that price? And how much of it would you buy if it was free? So, I mean, how much of it would you take if it was free? So decision making is not just about one thing.
Mm-hmm. This is a little bit off topic, but that description you just gave reminded me of someone who I know who studies how people make decisions about hospitals and how hospitals should be staffed. And so that automation is one horizon. It's on the horizon of a lot of hospitals. You know, how many positions can we automate? And this will save the hospital money because they don't need to pay as many human practitioners. And what they would do is they would say, automation of, you know, a certain percentage of doctors will open up 10% more hospital beds, 20% more hospital beds, 30% more hospital beds. And people are so averse to medical professional roles being automated that they pretty much will say it's under 50% of people will be okay with automation, even if it opens up, you know, if it doubles the number of hospital beds that can be offered.
I wonder if that's something that's going to change now too, because, you know, telemedicine has really had to step to the forefront this past year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you could frame it more as a safety issue now, like, you know, saving the lives of medical practitioners.
Well, and I wonder too, if a hospital is automating, whose jobs are first on the chopping block? Are we talking about it? You know, the doctor, sometimes it's, you think that doctors are the only person who works at a hospital, but there are nurses. And I think that's the job that I would least want automated is the nurse.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's janitors, there's cafeteria workers, there's technicians, there's orderlies. There's probably a lot of areas where people are more comfortable with automation, even if that's just a prestige bias.
Yeah. Yeah, because I think this study was looking at doctors in particular, but of course I think that the responses would change a lot if it were, you know, custodians.
Man, if they automated stuff and they made it cheaper to provide healthcare, I don't believe for a second that would result in more hospital beds or lower premiums or anything. So maybe I'm jaded, pessimistic about the state of healthcare in America.
You're one of those people in the 50% who's like, no automation, don't do it. Which is a status quo bias.
There you go. It all connects.
Yeah. If it was framed as so that we could have more hospital beds, I think I'd be for it, but I just don't buy it that as that's being the result.
I'd be more interested in less need for hospital beds.
Yeah, like better preventative care or better like in-home care.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, should we wrap up on this paper and move on to Josh's?
I think so.
Sure. All right. Yeah. I'm going to talk about something very different, but I think it was cool because, you know, when you think of cultural change, you're often thinking about big changes in how societies work. But I think Jamie's article was really interesting because it shows how cultural change really starts in individual people's minds and how we're so afraid of cultural change.
Well, and I picked that one because, you know, a status quo decision, Josh, would be to not stop doing podcasts. So I'm wondering what's going on in your mind that you were like, you know what? I'm going to change.
Well, you know, it's actually kind of relevant to your article because I've been so kind of overstretched for a long time in terms of work responsibilities and, you know, applying for jobs after I graduate. And going all the way back to last summer, I was thinking, you know, is this really something I can dedicate time to and do well podcasting with Useful Science while also taking care of all these other responsibilities? And I started asking questions, but it just was such a scary thing to leave this podcast. And I have so much fun doing it that it took me about, you know, 7 or 8 months to finally make the decision.
So if anyone's listening and you need a psychology postdoc, Josh is looking.
Yeah.
Is that what I'm hearing? Yeah.
Yeah. And maybe somebody who has experience in podcasting, if that's a plus.
Science communication.
There you go.
It helps. I don't know, Josh, you might not want to mention that. Might be more of a negative than a positive.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe.
have you heard my podcast?
Questions not to ask when you're being interviewed. Okay, well, I'll talk about my article. I'm going to talk about one of those big cultural changes. I'm going to talk about change in individualism, collectivism. You probably heard of this because it's one of these psychological constructs that's made it outside of the ivory tower. But if you haven't, it's basically the degree to which society emphasizes individual people's autonomy and their achievements. So this is individualism versus your community collective responsibilities. This is collectivism. So at a deeper level, it goes beyond just what society is all about, because there's a lot of research showing that individualism, collectivism is really about how we define ourselves too. So when I answer the question, who is Josh, the individualist in me might say that I'm a psychologist and I'm a runner. I love throwing frisbees. Whereas the collectivist might say that, you know, I'm a member of my family. I'm a member of the UNC Chapel Hill community. I'm a useful sciencer. And so it has this range of implications. And for a while, we've known that societies vary widely in whether they're more individualist or collectivist. And so South American and East Asian and African nations tend to be more collectivist, whereas European and North American countries tend to be more individualist. And there are a lot of theories about where these differences came from, which is not really the focus of today, but I think they're interesting. So one of them is that it has to do with ancient differences in how societies procured food and in the difference between making rice and making wheat as your staple crop. So the logic is that farming rice requires a large group, requires a lot of cooperation between different people. And so, you know, it cultural values that emphasize cooperation and coordination and harmony would be really useful if you're farming rice, whereas farming wheat is a relatively solitary task. And so, you know, to have cultural values about individual achievement and personal autonomy seems like it might be more useful. And then there's this other theory, even more recently was published, which has to do with the Catholic Church as the root of all individualism and collectivism today. And basically, it argues that people used to marry their cousins all the time because it kept wealth in their family lines. But, you know, in the Middle Ages, the Catholic Church decided that this was incest and they banned cousin marriage. And this forced people to go outside of their family units and to start interacting with strangers and getting broader social networks and getting jobs outside of their family and to do all other sorts of things that made them operate as individuals rather than family units. And so the logic is that exposure to the Catholic Church were the kind of earliest seeds that made European and other Anglo-Saxon nations so individualist.
In case anyone's wondering at home, fertility peaks at about the genetic level of third cousin. So
peaks.
So if you marry your sibling or your cousin, you're not going to have as many babies as if you marry your third cousin. And if you marry someone who comes from a very different genetic background, fertility is harder to achieve. So that's an issue with like first world countries where a lot of people come in and start marrying way further out from their groups. And we've got a mixture of people from different backgrounds, and fertility is affected by how similar or dissimilar. And it's not that you're not going to have your best luck if you're marrying your cousin, but after a point, it does start to be more difficult to conceive. And that's not to say it's impossible or that it's even noticeable, but it's statistically significant.
That is fascinating. I had no idea.
That's so interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know that there was, you know, I knew that, you know, individuals had different levels of fertility, but I didn't know that it was also like a compound thing in that way.
Yeah, well, you know, it takes two to tango.
This is maybe overstretching the finding, and you may not know the answer to this question. That's totally fine. But does that have anything to do with population level differences in fertility? Like Japan is really struggling with number of children at the moment, and they have all these policies encouraging fertility.
I know that it is more of a problem with first world nations.
Okay.
So due to genetic diversity. But there's also probably for countries like Finland or Japan, it is more about a cultural desire not to have children. So I lived in Japan, and at that point, I had some Japanese friends. They discussed like what they want out of life. And that was, oh gosh, that was 2006. So dated and anecdotal. But women were starting to want more out of life than just having children, and men weren't interested in supporting that. You know, if you married a woman, you were still expecting that she was going to stay home and essentially be a servant. So I don't know how much any of that plays into it, but there's a lot more to fertility than, you know, wanting to have a baby, because that's a huge part of it.
Mm-hmm.
Wanting to have a baby at the right time, and then wanting to have a baby at the right time with the right person. And so those are things that we understand from a social perspective, but there's a biological perspective that really complicates things.
Yeah. Yeah.
So if you're a first cousin, you share grandparents. If you're a second cousin, you share great grandparents. If you're a third cousin, you share great, great grandparents, I believe. So probably a pretty low risk of awkward family reunions at that point.
Well, we're not encouraging you to go out and find your third cousin.
Useful science tip for today.
And we're not saying like, it doesn't have to actually be your third cousin. But like, yeah, if you're doing those ancestry nasal swabs or whatever they do, where they test your genetics and tell you what kind of a person you are based on your DNA, you know, your DNA is made out of DNA. That's literally what those results are. They're looking at all these tiny little A's and T's and C's and G's and where they line up and what they code for. And I guess, you know, it's a little easier if you know your way around the code. A geneticist could be able to give you like an actual answer there.
Yeah, maybe a future episode on fertility.
Well, I think we would have to get someone who knows what they're talking about, because I just know about it. I have two kids, and then I donated eggs when I was younger.
All right, Josh, we'll let you go back to your paper now.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I mean, can I top this discussion about... I'll unpack that actually a little bit, the having children, because there are all sorts of things that are related to this rising individualism. And so what I was going to say is that those theories I shared earlier about the Catholic Church and farming, that's from these theories are talking about things that happened thousands of years ago. But there is some really interesting research happening now about a trend, both in Western and non-Western nations, towards greater individualism, some of the things that it's correlated with. So a lot of people have contributed to this research, but I'm going to highlight two people, Dr. Igor Grossman, who's at University of Waterloo, and Dr. Michael Varnum, who's at Arizona State University. And they've done a lot of work that I think really does a great job of unpacking this trend. So one of their better known studies was an analysis of cultural values and practices from 78 countries, so a huge sample, over 51 years. It's from 1960 to 2011. And most of their data came from big international panel surveys that were administered every few years during that time window. So there's one that some people may have heard of, the World Value Survey, which has hundreds of thousands of people in it and asked these items about how important it was to teach independence to one's children. Another item asked about how much people valued freedom of speech. There are all these items that were sort of getting it at individualist values that they averaged together. So if you agreed with those items, you'd be more of an individualist. And then they also had a different source of data, which asked people about behavioral metrics like household size or the percentage of people living alone or divorce rate. And so the idea is that in past research, smaller households and higher divorce rates, more people living alone have been these indicators of rising individualism. And when they analyzed these sets of items, they found a really striking trend. So both practices and values connoting individualism had risen about 12% from 1960 to 2011. And it didn't rise in every country. So a few countries like China and the Ukraine, Peru showed slightly more collectivist values. And then a few West African countries like Mali and Burkina Faso showed more collectivist practices. But the overwhelming majority shifted towards individualism. And this country-to-country variation was actually really useful for the authors because they were able to figure out which kinds of countries were most likely to rise in individualism. And they found that the countries that had the biggest effect were those that were getting wealthier. And it was even an even bigger effect if they were getting wealthier and they had relatively stable climates. So the idea was that one reason why everyone might be getting more individualist is because we just have more resources, we have more money, we have more time. There's more supporting us to go off on our own as individuals.
You can afford a Roomba.
Exactly. You can afford a room and a Roomba.
Yeah.
And they showed the same thing within the United States in a different paper. And so they used census data going all the way back to the early 19th century. So look at the average size of households and the prevalence of multi-generational households and divorce rates, the tendency to give children unique names, all of these different metrics. They even looked at like the frequency of words in literature related to individualism, like words like choose and achieve, which are related to individual achievement. Words like belong and duty would indicate collectivism. And they found that all of these indices of individualism, like divorce rate and small households and, you know, single generation households, all of these things were on the rise and that the frequency of collectivist words was dropping.
I have a question.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I mean, words like achieve and choose and things like that, those are individualist, but what if your achievements are, what if you're really being encouraged to achieve by your family? Which is definitely something that people have experienced. You know, your family's telling you, you need to achieve. Your mm-hmm. family's telling you, you need to choose things.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that something that they have any notes on?
Well, I actually have a whole blog post about the challenges of interpreting this kind of literature data. I have this blog at Psychology Today, which I haven't contributed to for a while, but I have this blog post on the, you know, trying to analyze cultural change using books because it's such a great source of data because it goes back so far and we have these, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of books that are waiting to be analyzed, but it's really challenging because you can't see the context. You can't see whether people are talking about individual achievement or whether they're talking about, you know, achievement on behalf of their family or for their family.
Can you get us the link to that for like when this episode drops?
Definitely. There are a few things you can do to see whether you're measuring what you think you're measuring. And so one thing you can do is you can see whether it correlates with other kinds of data sources that are connoting individualism. So you can see whether it actually predicts the things it should predict. You can also look to see whether it correlates with other words that are related to the phenomena you think you're studying. So if you just have a word like achieve, you might have a really unreliable index. But if you have index of like 30 different words that you think are getting individualism. They're all correlating really highly with each other. So, you know, people are using the word choose a lot in 1989, and they also just happen to be using the word achieve a lot. Then you can take these baby steps towards getting more confidence in your linguistic index.
Oh, that's interesting. We do something very similar when we ask people about their fatigue.
Oh, yeah. So what do you do?
Well, you know, fatigue is hard to explain. And so when you're asking someone and you're trying to get at, are they sleepy? Are they sleep deprived? Are they tired? Are they burnt out? Are they unmotivated? You kind of just ask them the whole spectrum and then calibrate it from there. There's a fatigue visual analog scale. Is like, it gives you a bar, and it's on one end it says very sleepy and then not at all sleepy, and you move the bar to where you are at that moment, and you got to go down this whole list. Very alert, not at all alert. Super pumped, not super pumped. Like, it goes on asking in different synonyms how tired you are.
Yeah. So that's these are good practices for anyone who wants to develop a scale, whether it's a kind of word count scale or whether it's a self-report agreement scale, like the one that you're describing, to have more items. And so you can make sure that they're all converging on some phenomena that you're interested in, rather than getting at something idiosyncratic. And so I find this trend really interesting. And I think that it's important as well. And for a few different reasons that are probably considered useful. And so for one, I think that all of these different indicators of rising individualism, so rising divorce rate, more people living alone, people are having fewer children. There's this surge of like weird idiosyncratic names. Like, who named their kid Apple? Was it Gwyneth Paltrow? I don't remember. Mm,
I named my son Templeton.
Okay. Yeah. So we often think of these things in isolation. We often think like, oh, well, why is divorce rate going up? Or why are more people naming their children Apple or Templeton? But I think that this is kind of cool because it shows that these things correlate really highly from year to year, even when you remove this upward trend. You know, if there's a dip in individualist naming practices, there's also a dip in single generation households. And so they're all kind of related to this underlying theme. And then it predicts all sorts of other things. So Jeannie Twang at San Diego State University has done these really cool analyses of pop music lyrics and fiction books. And she finds that both sources of data are using more and more personal pronouns like I and my, and fewer collective pronouns like we and us, which is tied in with this rising individualism.
I wonder how many BTS songs use words for like me versus words for us. Do you guys know BTS?
I feel naive, but I don't know BTS.
It's K-pop,
BTS,
right?
Let me look up the full name. This is a K-pop band, and they've taken the world by storm. So I guess the full name is Bangtan Sonyeondang. So that's their name. And it's a 7-member South Korean boy band. And they are massive hits right now.
Yeah, come on, Josh.
Like, they sing in Korean.
Well, that's actually a really interesting hypothesis, because I guess you'd predict that relative to Americans, they're using more collective pronouns.
Well, I know that Korean and Japanese are related languages.
Yeah.
And I know I speak Japanese, and I know that there's the way that you refer to yourself or to other people is different. There's no polite way to say you.
It's anata, right? Anata no, like your.
Yeah. So like, but that's rude. Like, you don't, you wouldn't say that to someone at the grocery store. That would be somewhat, be like, you, what are you doing? And then there's another way to say you, which is omae, which literally means like thing in front of me.
Yeah.
And that you use, like, anata would be like for a friend or a girlfriend, and omae, that's like either you're really close or you're insulting that person.
Huh.
And then a lot of times the we, there's not really a like, you can just use the, there's not like a singular, you can just use watashi to refer to everyone. And I mean, more commonly you say like watashi dashi, which is like all of us. But that's a little slangy. And so I wonder if this is an English-focused finding, or if this is something that could be extrapolated across Roman languages and beyond to languages that use a lot of different ways of referring not only to yourself, but to other people.
Well, what you say is actually really interesting, because it reminds me of a related phenomenon called colexification, which is when you have a single word to express two different concepts. And so watashi can, if you can use it to refer to both I and we, that's meaningful from a linguistic standpoint, because colexifications often happen when people see two concepts as similar enough in meaning to give a single word. And so if collectivist societies are more likely to develop languages where I and we are interchangeable, then that is actually indicating that there might be more kind of confluence between the meanings of I and we. So kind of going to this point about your own identity as part of a broader identity.
Well, and there's multiple ways to say I. So watashi is I, and that's the polite way of saying it. But young men or tomboys would say boku. Girly girls would say atashi. Manly men, like guys who fart and have tattoos, would say ore. And then women who fart and have tattoos would say like uchi. So there's more than one way to say I. And I know that's at least one language does that. I wonder how many other languages are like this, and if this individualism is on the rise, regardless of the Western focus of the country, then it would be interesting to do an analysis of music across different languages and see if, or, you know, literature research and see if these words that have an individual meaning are on the rise regardless of the language.
Yeah. It'd be so interesting to look at those different ways of expressing the concept of I. You know, it's funny actually. I've been taking Japanese classes for the last couple of years, and uchi is the way that Duolingo talks about we, and boku and watashi is the way that it refers to I. So I don't know what is going on there.
Well, okay, so there, Japanese language changes, and there's a lot of slang, and so I don't know, but yeah, I was told, like, the girls at my cafe would sometimes use uchi, and one of the managers would use uchi, even though he was a man, that confused the heck out of me. But the point is that there's multiple ways to refer to yourself, which we don't have in English.
Yeah.
And there's way less ways to refer to other people. I guess we have you or y'all or yous or yins if you're American and from Pittsburgh. So, you know, like, it's interesting. And then in Spanish, there's you, like tú. And then there's the vosotros, which they really only use in Spain. And that's like y'all, you know, you all. And they don't use that in South America or other Spanish-speaking countries as much as they do in Spain. So, like, every language has this variation on how you refer to people, and probably different connotations for how individualistic a word like achieve is.
Yeah.
And probably doing that literature search would require more collective work than farming rice.
Yeah, true. And doing these studies of language, I do a lot of this research as well, and it's hugely taxing. It requires a lot of people with different expertise to come together. I wanted to talk about one more thing that I think could be interesting about a world of changing individualism. And it's about well-being or wellness, and some different results you get depending on how you ask questions about wellness in individualist and collectivist countries. And so about maybe 20 years ago, maybe more, there was this wave of research showing that people in collectivist societies, and in particular in East Asia, were scoring a lot lower on self-esteem. So when you ask people kind of, how good do you feel about yourself? Are you a person of worth? People in East Asian countries were answering a lot lower on the scale than Americans. And so there was this there was all this research about why is this? Is it because East Asians are less happy? Is it because they just like are less willing to self-promote? But more recently, there's been this research coming out by professors Yuffie Ogihara, I hope I didn't say that wrong, and Yukiko Uchida, which has found that individualistic people in Japan actually report lower life satisfaction. So when you change the wording of those self-esteem items to be more about like how much do you enjoy life, individualists are actually answering lower on those questions than collectivists. And I actually have done an analysis. I have a paper under review at the moment, which looks at global variation in major depressive disorder. And we have all of these predictors in this paper, ranging from malnutrition to inequality and wealth, climate variables, sunlight exposure, divorce rate, probably about 15 predictors. And of all of those, the best predictor of major depressive disorder across countries is actually individualism. It's just correlated really strongly, even when you control for the number of psychiatrists in individualist countries versus collectivist countries and the number of other diagnoses. And so I've been kind of trying to think through this and what it means in a world of rising individualism.
You know, that makes sense to me. So I struggled with severe depression for years. Mm-hmm. And right about before I went to Japan, I was really noticing that this was something I should do something about, that this was impacting my life. And for years, I would say, you know, I'm sad, but I'm still able to function. So I must not be depressed, even though I really did not enjoy life. And, you know, that might be because I was getting a degree in biology and psychology and was working really hard. But no, I was depressed before that. One, and I've always been a very individualistic person. I think most people would probably use the word weird. When I went to Japan, nobody expected me to fit in. And it was such a relief because I look like a Barbie and people expect when you look like a Barbie, you're going to act like a Barbie. And it confuses the crap out of them when you don't. And so I could see why an individualistic person may have problems, not because they don't like themselves, but because there's such friction and such demand for other people for you to fit in. And when I came home from Japan, I thought, this is great. You know, it's great to go somewhere and live somewhere where no one expects that you're going to be normal. No one expects that you're going to fit in. And then I moved to Boston and I actually did find a place where I fit in. And that was something that I didn't think would happen. I didn't think that there were people like me in the world. And I found it. And so I've been able to get over a lot of my innate depression that held me back for years by understanding how I'm connected to other people and how the people around you affect your ability to be happy.
Well, that's really powerful. And I think that probably a much more eloquent way of talking about the link between collectivism and depression than anything I could have written. It's probably a good place to kind of wrap up this discussion of individualism and what it means for the world.
Well, it's a individual report as opposed to like an actual scientific paper.
Yeah, well, I guess it's always good to have a balance of those two things, you know, because...
Well, we're trying to communicate.
Yeah, if you're listening to this podcast, it helps to have the data, which I think exists with both the phenomena of rising individualism and also the consequences it might have for mental health and well-being. But I think that just, you know, data is always great when you can link it to people's experiences and when you can see how this actually plays out. And so, yeah, I mean, thanks so much for sharing that from your own life.
It's so I have thought about it. And one of the things is, you know, I've had some bad times and I thought, well, one thing I can do is I can talk about it. You know, I can't help other people. I can't make other people feel like they're okay to talk about their life experiences, but I can talk about mine and not be ashamed of mine. And so that's something that I try to do. Mm-hmm. But yeah, most of the people listening to our podcast, they're not going to need to pass a test. So the data and the numbers and all of that is probably going to be less interesting to them than if they can understand it. And if we use anecdotes or analogies or something, then hopefully that gets in somehow.
Yeah.
Helps those numbers stick.
You know, one film that I saw recently, for those who might be interested in kind of another anecdotal way of looking at this, is I think it was called The Farewell. Have either of you heard of this movie?
Yeah, I watched that. Awkwafina.
Yeah. I thought it was my favorite film I've seen in the last few years. I was crying so much by the end. And I just thought that's the best I've seen this idea of collectivism versus individualism put into a story and really driving a story, and has all sorts of implications for how people interact with their families and how people feel about their own self. And so if you're listening to this and you want to watch a good movie tonight, or I don't know, over the weekend, whenever this airs, then I recommend it.
Yeah, I think it's on Amazon, but don't quote me.
I think it is.
What was it called?
The Farewell.
The Farewell.
So if you Google The Farewell, Awkwafina, mm-hmm. it'll pop right up.
Yeah.
And Awkwafina, if I'm saying it, no one knows, it's spelled like awkward. Awkwafina. She's a performer. She's a comedian. She's been in a number of things.
Yeah, I know her from Ocean's 8. I think it's the only thing I've seen her in. Yeah.
Jumanji 2.
Oh yeah, Jumanji 2. She's a scene stealer in most movies, but she was the main character in this one.
And she was incredible. Such a great performer.
I'd be great at performing someone who can't speak Chinese.
All right, I guess we'll wrap things up then. Thank you so much for listening. That was a great episode, and thank you, Josh, for joining us for these 5 years, these 50 plus episodes, or some portion of them. We love to hear from our listeners. You can email us at podcast@usefulscience.org. You can follow us on Twitter @usefulsci and on Instagram @usefulscience. We're also looking for contributors to the website. This is people to help us find interesting science articles and write summaries for them and peer review those summaries. So we always need a big team to do that. And if you'd like to get involved in that project, you can just go to our contact page, usefulscience.org/contact, and drop us a line. I want to thank our editor from the Morehead Planetarium, Vivian Lee, and the composer of our intro music, Solomon Krauss-Imlaw. My name is Cameron Spencer. The thing I'm plugging this year is my YouTube account, actually. If you just search for USONIC, USONIC, you can find me on YouTube. And I've been posting project video every week, woodworking, metalworking, 3D printing, that sort of stuff.
I'm Jamie K. Devine. You can follow me on Twitter @JK_Devine. And I'm going to be cracking open a Schlitz to congratulate Josh for his last episode.
Thanks, Jamie. And I'm Josh. You can follow me on Twitter @Josh_C_Jackson. And no woodworking on my Twitter page, unfortunately. But lots of interesting science and hopefully some more studies on cultural change.
Thank you so much for listening. I hope you have a very useful week.